CME from the sun that produced some stunning auroras up in the very north right now. I haven't been able to see anything further down south here in Sweden yet where I'm right now. But wow, amazing and crazy stuff happening all at once, of course. I hope you take the opportunity to look at some of our recent articles about the 2012 Sion Olympics and the symbolism surrounding that. Things are heating up indeed. And especially with that mini-sun that they lit up in Trafalgar Square as well a few days ago. Ratios connecting the fake sun to the Grand Lodge of England on Queen Street. And the Olympic Stadium as well in Stratford. Big Ben is leaning, and who knows, maybe someone will tip it over during the Olympic Games. We'll see what happens there, huh? We're also very sad, of course, to announce the passing of David Flynn, one of our guests here on Red Eyes Radio. We've taken his interviews out from our archive and made them available for everyone to hear and take part of his wisdom and research. So please take a look at the page that we created for David, where we've linked up some of his material, including our radio program with him, and some of his video presentations. Some amazing stuff in there. David was only 49, much too young, very sad indeed. Today we are going to get an update on the ongoings in Egypt with our friend Robert Bovol, one of the cradles of early human civilization that has so much to offer, has gone through some massive turmoil in the last 12 months or so. And we are going to hear about the dethroned pharaohs of the antiquities and the new incoming guys there as well, but also about the very sad destruction of much of the amazing art and temples that has been happening throughout the centuries now. Stay with us for much more. Welcome back, Robert. It's excellent to talk to you once again. How has the winter, in if you have such a thing in Spain, been so far, Robert, for you?
Well, we haven't had a real winter. I mean, it's quite amazing. I'm actually, as always, sitting in my office looking at outside the window, and I'm looking at the sea. It's the sun is about to set, and it's a beautiful day. I mean, amazing. People were swimming this morning. There you go.
Wow.
Yeah, the Costa del Sol, as you know, can be very, very nice in the winter, and we've had 3 weeks of superb weather. So I'm advertising the Costa del Sol.
Yeah. Well, they need everyone they can get down there now, don't they?
Well, you know, we came back from England this morning, and the flight was absolutely full. Really, I mean, I'm quite amazed that a lot of people are coming at this time of year, but it seems to be very very popular, probably because of the low prices.
Well, you know what, Robert, every time I fly, all the flights are always packed to the brim, and I'm amazed if we're in a so-called economic depression. You think people would stay home more, and you had some, you know, leg room in some of these planes, but nope.
You're absolutely right. You know, I was in Oxford, when was it, yesterday? Sorry, before yesterday. Before yesterday, we were in Oxford, and we went to a Ashmolean Museum, and then we went walking in town, and you'd think quite the opposite. I mean, there was thousands of people in the streets. The restaurants were full. You had to wait outside to get a place. I mean, there didn't seem to be an economic crisis at all.
I know.
I don't know who's having the economic crisis.
Exactly. Well, it's been my point as well. People are out there shopping. Their, you know, bags are full, you know, it seems like, in a way. So
you know what? It's a bit like the situation in Egypt, you know? I mean, you see it on television, and people call me and say, my God, you know, what's happening? And you know, there's riots in the street, and then I get people calling me from Egypt saying everything's fine, you know, and the shops are everybody's shopping, everybody's in the restaurants, everybody's in the cafes. So I think the media is kind of overdoing certain things, I think.
This is a very good point. I think that they love to jump on the occasion when things actually start to unfold, and I mean, from my perspective, when I watched you know, Al Jazeera and some of the other channels last February, was it then, in 2011 March, something like that, It's almost like, you know, the pyramids are on fire, that kind of reporting, you know what I mean?
I can tell you, I was there with a group in May, and I was there again in November, and you keep saying, where is the revolution? You know, everything seems to be normal in Cairo. Fair enough. I mean, there are occasionally these clashes in Tahrir Square, but this is very, very localized. You step out of Tahrir Square and walk in other parts of Cairo, and it's as if nothing is going on. You know, it's. You know, I think the media. We discussed this last time. I mean, news have become very much rating, looking for the kind of sensational approach to news. And I put a lot of pinch and salt on what I hear on the news, because, you know, I travel a lot, and when you go to the location where they're supposed to be, what they're telling us, you know, I mean, very often, you know, okay, there are troubles in Iraq, for example, but and then you see a documentary and everybody's in the shops shopping around and going to restaurants, you know, and it's bizarre, you know.
Yeah, it's true. It's what's being reported is usually not as bad, and then things can be really bad, and those stories are actually unreported. It's interesting how that is, but I think that's a wise outlook, Robert, as you said, take everything with a pinch of salt, and just know that the media are going for these sensationalistic pieces all the time, basically. But
well, of course, you know, I mean, Egypt is a country of 90 million people. And if you're going to report two people arguing with each other in the street or hitting each other, you know, people think it's representative of all the country.
Yeah.
And so there is this kind of very focused, sensationalist news. I was, by the way, in New York when they had the Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the impression one got is that it was chaos and all of Wall Street was in pandemonium and there was riots in the street. I actually went there and I had a great time. I mean, people were very calm and things were very... So, you know, it's not... Of course, they pick up. I mean, I'm not saying what they show is not true, but it's very localized and it's very focused, and it doesn't represent what else is going on. So
that's right. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. And while we're on the subject of things happening in Egypt, though, I mean, I want to ask you basically what really is happening in Egypt, what you're hearing from your point of view, because a recurring theme, Robert, every time we kind of connect, has been this unfolding drama, if you will, of the Secretary General of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in Egypt. What do you know about what happened to Hawass, and what do you know about the new guy?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a brief overview, because it's been rather confusing of what's been happening since the revolution. But let me run down. I mean, what happened during the January uprising is that President Mubarak, before he was ousted, formed a new government, or rather he shuffled the government, and to the surprise of everybody, he created a new ministry, the Ministry of Antiquities, and Hawass was appointed minister, the very first minister of antiquities. There is a need to understand the reason for this. One is to separate the ministry, the antiquities, which was always run by a Supreme Council of Antiquities under the authority of the Ministry of Culture. Yes? This had happened before let me get this right, in 2009, when Hawass had reached the age of retirement. Now, in Egypt, a government official who has reached the age of retirement, which is 63, has to retire, unless he is a minister or a vice minister. And since Hawass was not either, Mubarak created a new post. They created the post of vice minister of culture. So Hawass became a vice minister of culture, hence he was able to stay in charge of the antiquities as director of the Supreme Council. So it was kind of a strange situation, and it was very clear that Mubarak, or rather Suzan Mubarak, as it's becoming clearer and clearer, very much supported Hawass. there is a relationship between the ex first lady Suzanne Mubarak and Hawass, which is not very clear. It's been investigated at the moment, but they clearly, one thing is clear, that they were extremely close, and she very much supported and influenced decisions made on his behalf. So this is the first one that came out. And then, like I said earlier, during the January uprising, Mubarak formed this new government and created the new Ministry of Antiquities, and Hawass was made minister. Mm-hmm. This was, of course, to allow him to stay as part of the new government. Of course, this new government was quickly dissolved when Mubarak was ousted. But strangely enough, Hawass stayed in his position for quite a few months. Then the new Prime Minister Sharaf, decided to reshuffle the government. And at that point, Hawass resigned. This was, I think, in March or April. And then, surprise, surprise, 2 weeks later, he was reappointed as Minister of Antiquities.
Right.
We think it's almost sure that there was a lot of pressure from the military council on the Prime Minister to take Hawass back. And this raised a lot of questions as to what was going on. In any case, protests were organized against Hawass, and finally, when it was revealed in the New York Times, let me get this right, I think it was early July, that Hawass had been, it was well known that he was explorer in residence for the National Geographic in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
He was appointed the explorer in residence in 2001, among only eight others of the National Geographic. Now, what was revealed in the New York Times in July was that he had been receiving a stipend, a payment of $200,000 per year for this privilege. And this infuriated the protesters, mainly most of them because they hadn't been receiving their salaries, and many of them wanted to get a raise in their salaries. And once they discovered that Hawass was being paid such an enormous sum per year. Now, since he was appointed, 10 years have passed, so he has at least received $2 million, which is quite a lot of money in Egypt. So that caused a huge reaction, and finally the Prime Minister asked Hawass to resign, to leave.
Yeah.
And so Hawass left, and this was the 19th of July. I must say, propitiously, this is the official date of the Haleakal Rising of Sirius.
Yeah, just a coincidence. No way.
Well, I'm sure it's a coincidence, but it's rather odd how these things happen.
Well, wasn't it even... Mubarak has basically been in power for, was it 29, almost 30 years. And I heard another cycle that if you can view Mubarak as the current pharaoh, if you will, of Egypt still, you know, this is a tradition been kept, right?
Yes, strange enough, it is the 30 years of the Hebset festival.
There you go.
Yeah, how odd. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Well done.
That's why I think that things that go on in Egypt are still very much ritualistic, although we might not get this through the news, but also know how to read between the lines, can discover some tidbits I think.
Yes, I'm going to tell you something during the course of this interview about a very strange date. I think we discussed it briefly last time, but I'd like to bring it out again because I'm still very intrigued at a happening in Paris. You remember we discussed this?
I do. It's a fascinating story.
Yes, I'll bring it up again because I think that these dates are very strange. I mean, for example, Rudolf Gantry discovered the door on the 22nd of March, which of course was the spring equinox. And you get these kind of strange synchronicities. Sometimes, of course, a pure coincidence. But at other times, I wonder, you know. But anyway, to carry on with the story of Hawass, so that's it. I mean, that's it. He left in July. In fact, he left in a huff and puff because when he finally, literally, physically walked out of the Ministry of antiquities, he was mobbed by a very angry crowd. And I don't know if you've seen the YouTube on this one. He was nearly lynched. Oh, yeah, the crowd were very upset, chanting thief, thief, and American spy, and all sorts of strange accusations. Mm-hmm. And he was protected by his bodyguards and whisked into a taxi, and the crowd lurched itself on the taxi and wanted to pull him out. So it was rather a weird thing to see. And he barely escaped. But anyway, so that was his finale. Since then, I understand that he's been on a travel ban, like most ministers of the old regime. They're all on travel bans. There's about over 40 court cases against him, going from corruption to mismanagement to misappropriation of funds, to all sorts of accusations of that kind, black marketing, and so he is in a rather odd position. But he is, unrepentant. I mean, he keeps, he's a very strange man, and the last I heard, he put an article in the Akhbar al-Yom, Ahmed Osman, my co-author, told me that he put an article yesterday or before yesterday, saying that he will reveal the whole truth about what happened during this year of the revolution. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how he's going to do it, but rumors is that he's writing a book which is nearly finished, a sort of autobiography, and talking also of the events of the revolution, which ironically. Since I just said this, as you may know, Ahmed Osman, the Egyptian journalist and writer, and myself have just completed a book on the story of antiquities, and particularly of Hawass. So this is going to be rather strange to have his book coming out, which of course is going to be very very full of self-praise, and we are exposing all his... all his misconduct. Mm-hmm.
No, that's great. I mean, you might recall, Robert, we had Ahmed Osman with us back in October last year, and I think we briefly mentioned this title as well. So it's just coming out, or has it just been released? Tell us that again.
Well, the book has been finished. It was delivered in December, and we're now waiting for the publisher to begin editing. We're hoping to have it published before July, but there is a discussion at the moment with the publisher as to the exact date of publication. So it's at this stage. But the book, let me explain it. I'm very pleased with this book. It's a book that it was done, very, very topical, of course, because it deals with the events that have happened in the last year in Egypt. But the story actually starts with the arrival of Napoleon in Egypt in 1789, which is really the beginning of two things. It's the beginning of modern Egypt, and it's also the beginning of the story of antiquities, or rather the antiquity department. Mm-hmm. We tell these two stories in parallel because they're both entwined. You know, the antiquities are very entangled with the events of modern Egypt and the revolutions that happened in 1952 and so forth, and vice versa. So it's a kind of very interesting book that for whoever is not only interested in antiquities but interested to understand what's happening in Egypt and why there's been a revolution and what's happened to the antiquities during all these 60 years of almost dark ages, the book does a very good job to expose all this. And even myself, I was not aware of many of the things that happened until we started researching.
Yeah, usually the case, isn't it?
Indeed, yes, indeed. Well, you see, I mean, although I was born in Egypt, Heinrich, as you know, and I've focused all my research on ancient Egypt. I mean, this was primarily my my main interest. However, this book kind of forced both myself, Rahel Osman, to review and research the events of modern Egypt, and particularly the antiquities, since 1789. And it's a rather shocking story when you research it in this way, as you will see when hopefully you read the book, Heinrich. Much destruction and vandalism and mismanagement and misappropriation and stealing has been going on over the last 200 years. Amazing that anything is left. I mean, there are stories which are absolutely incredible. You know, whole temples have been dismantled.
Really?
Can you
give us one example of something that might come to your memory right now of how... Is this because of negligence, or has this been like a plan? What do you think?
Let me just briefly, of course, because it's a rather long story, but not counting the vandalism that occurred in remote antiquity. Of course, there was a lot of tomb robbing during pharaonic times. Much desecration took place with robbing tombs of pharaohs and so forth. We know that. Also, during the Persian occupation, some destruction took place. But Egypt was relatively, or rather pharaonic Egypt, was relatively intact by the time of the arrival of the Romans. Much of the temples were still intact. The city of Memphis was still very much active, Heliopolis. So really, until then, there was a lot that survived. But then came the Arab invasion destruction started in the 4th century when the Christians, or rather the Roman Empire, became Christians, and the edict of Theodosius, let me get this right, in 391 A.D., ordering the closure of the temples, this caused quite a lot of vandalism and destruction. The Serapeum in Alexandria, for example, was totally destroyed, and many of the temples were desecrated. Luckily, one thing happened, is that the Christian were... keen to convert Egyptian temples into churches. So much of the temples, Phila, for example, and many temples in Upper Egypt survived because they were converted into churches. So, but nonetheless, destructions did occur. Of course, the Library of Alexandria was burnt and all sorts of vandalism.
Yeah.
But finally, in the 7th century, the Arabs occupied Egypt and converted it into Islam. Now, the problem with Islam was, and still is, that it abhors paganism. It abhors icons and representations of pagan gods and pagan deities and so forth. So, but even then, early Islam was not particularly destructive. I mean, we have two or three episodes that were kind of spooky. We know that one of the sultans actually wanted to dismantle the pyramids.
He sent build a big mosque out of it, huh?
Well, they did. I mean, much of the temples, or rather the pyramids, because they had set the new capital, Fustat, which eventually became Cairo, in the 8th century, 9th century. And much of the Arab Islamic Cairo was built from stones from the pyramids. Mm. For example, the casing stones were literally stripped off the pyramids to be used. And you can still see this when you go in old Cairo. You can see some of the stones of the pyramids used as stones for entrances to mosques and gates and so forth.
Is it that pristine kind of white, very chalk type stone?
Yes, there is no doubt that the stone came from the pyramids.
Yeah.
There are many accounts describing the stripping of stones and the quarrying of stones from the pyramids. But even then, you know, surprisingly, a lot of it survived. when Napoleon came to Egypt in 1789 and landed with his troops, 30,000 troops in Alexandria, and brought along with him the famous savants, the scientists from the French Institute, and about 170 they were. They say, it's kind of sad really, they say that they actually cried because they expected to find this amazing universal city of antiquities, the ancient Alexandria with its temples and palaces and villas, and there was nothing. Everything had gone. Mm. And they got a shock. I mean, well, we know that some of it survived, of course, now with archaeology we can, and much of it survived in the sea, luckily.
Yeah.
But really, very little was left, and the population of Alexandria had dwindled to 6,000. It was very pathetic.
What was the earlier number? How many do you think was there? Initially.
Well, Alexandria in Ptolemaic times, at least a quarter of a million, if
wow.
not more.
Really?
Jeez. No, it was a big city. It was one of the big cities of antiquities. Very sophisticated, of course, with its library and with its museums and palaces.
Yep.
And universities. No, it was an amazing city. In fact, when the Arabs took it over, it was still intact in the 7th century, and there's this famous letter that Amr Abdel As, the general of the Arab army, sent to the Khalif in Mecca, saying, "I've been given a city, literally given, because the keys were handed to him, and the Romans left." And he said, "I've been given a city with 4,000 baths and 4,000 villas." And he says that when they enter the city, they have to shield their eyes because there was so much white marble with the palaces and the villas that they were blinded by this amazing, dazzling light coming from the city. So it must have been quite something.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's it. The city disappeared by the early 18th century. It was gone.
No upkeep. And was it dismantled consequently as well, then, as you said? That's
yes.
The main,
it was, well, first, the story goes that the Arabs moved in. But then the canal that fed the city from the Nile got silted up. They didn't bother to clean it, so the city was out of water, and they moved their stronghold to the port of Damietta. So Damietta became an Arab stronghold, and Alexandria was just left to the elements.
Hmm.
And I mean, I was born in Alexandria, as you know, so I know a lot about it.
Yeah, I bet.
People are usually very surprised and disappointed because when I take tourists to Alexandria, there is nothing left. I mean, there is the modern city, of course, but very little left of the ancient city.
Yeah.
But anyway, coming to the antiquities, what happened after Napoleon's departure is that, and this is a very strange story, really. I mean, during the Napoleonic occupation of Egypt, the British, of course, with Nelson, mounted a fleet to come and attack Napoleon and in Egypt. And they joined forces with the Ottoman Empire, because Napoleon, of course, had occupied Egypt and ousted the Ottomans who were running Egypt at the time. And so the Ottomans, the Turks, joined forces with Egypt, and they sent various regiments. In one of the regiments where they recruited people from Macedonia and various other parts of the Turkish empire, one of their officers, and rather an uncouth one who was totally uneducated, well, couldn't even write his name, was called Muhammad Ali. But a very, very powerful sort of character who eventually, when Napoleon was ousted from Egypt, took hold of Egypt and became its first modern ruler.
Hmm.
He was an Albanian. He did not speak Arabic. And it is Muhammad Ali who started what is known as modern Egypt, and his dynasty ruled till the ousting of King Farouk in 1952. I was born in those days. So it is a very strange thing that Egypt became ruled by a dynasty of Albanians. And they were, Muhammad Ali was very, on the one hand, you know, to be fair on his activities, he realized very quickly that Egypt, if Egypt had to survive in the modern world, it had to join the modern world. And he took as model, of course, the British and the French, who were the superpowers in the time, and went on a huge, huge spree to modernize Egypt. And invited, indeed, French engineers, and particularly the French, actually, to help him modernize Egypt. Now, as luck would have it, in America, there was the Civil War, and Egypt was in competition with America with the sale of cotton. The main produce of Egypt, until now, as a matter of fact, is cotton. And therefore, the price of cotton shot up because of the American Civil War, it shot up in Egypt, and the coffers of Muhammad Ali filled up, and he had a lot of money to spare, so he invited all these foreign companies, and a bit like Saudi Arabia in modern times, to develop the country. But to move quickly and to build the factories and to build the dams so that they could control the Nile and irrigate the fields, they actually used the stones from the temples. And it is a frightening thing that they actually literally dismantled whole temples. I mean, we know this because many of the temples that were described by the Napoleonic scientists in the famous Description de l'Egypte have disappeared. At least 20 temples were totally dismantled and gone. The city of Ashmunein, the city of the god Hermes, Thoth, completely dismantled. So there was a lot of destruction, mainly because these Albanians were totally disinterested in the antiquities.
And it's not their culture inherently either. So they're like, yeah, whatever, let's do something that demands the least amount of effort, maybe. So they just took what was there, basically.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, there was something else going on at the time. Although they did not care about the antiquities and were not interested, who really got interested were the Europeans.
That's right.
And therefore, the Muhammad Ali saw a double income. On the one hand, he was using the antiquities to develop his factories and the dams. And on the other hand, he allowed foreigners to come and say, well, we want to buy this temple. And, you know, for peanuts, he actually would give them presents. I mean, all the obelisks that left Egypt in those days were literally given as presents. And so if you wanted the temple, you were friendly with the Khedive of Egypt, you go and say, well, you know, how about it? And he would say, yeah, I'll take it. So much of it was literally vandalized this way. And of course came the carpetbaggers, you know, who started excavating illegally, and they were left to excavate wherever they wanted, and they began to export things, and then the black market started. So all this went on, unabated, unsupervised. Then finally, a Frenchman, ironically, Auguste Mariette, put a stop to this and proposed to the then Khedive Said, a descendant of Muhammad Ali, in 1850, to found the museum, the very first museum, and organize the very first antiquity department, the famous Service des Antiquités. And it is then that starts the real story of the antiquity department, of which Hawass, of course, was the end product. But even though Auguste Mariette succeeded in stopping much of the black market trade and the vandalism, it still went on for quite a while. And indeed, unfortunately, it's still going on. And of course, during the revolution, which is one of the things we report in this book. You know, when the reins of power were removed and the police during the I'm talking about the recent revolution and the police were disappeared, there was a huge reaction by vandals and burglars and much more than we think has been stolen and destroyed.
Can we, Robert? Can we compare it at all to the what happened in Iraq? a lot of artifacts and things were stolen from the museums there and things. Was it as bad in Egypt, do you think? Can we compare?
That's the problem, is that when during the January Revolution of last year, when all this was going on, Hawass was telling the world that everything was okay, and that not much had been taken, and he was downplaying the story very much. And the trouble is that people believed him, and because of that, much went on, because otherwise many of the international organizations would have sent their people to attempt to stop the vandalism, UNESCO, for example. So Hawass is very much responsible for causing the situation to become worse. I'm very upset with this, because he should have pulled the whistle rather than say, no, nothing has happened, and so forth. Now we know that much has happened, not just in central Cairo with the museum. We're still waiting for the full inventory to be listed. But much was taken from other storehouses and museums around the country. Indeed, illegal excavations still now are going on, because the situation is not fully under control yet. So, we're trying to clarify all this and expose all this. And you know what we're trying to do with this book, Heinrich, is to actually tell the truth. Because Egypt has lived under a regime for 60 years where they camouflage the reality. According to the Egyptian authorities, everything was okay, and the country was prosperous, and the people were happy, and it wasn't true. And they created their own history, if you like. Mm. They created their own propaganda history, very much like the Nazis did, where everything was fine, and there was no genocide and so forth. Well, the same thing happened in Egypt. And one of the things that will save Egypt, and particularly save the antiquities, is that the Egyptians, thank goodness, are waking up to all this. And they have to recognize what really happened. They have to admit the truth. They have to say, yes, all this has happened, and we mustn't let it happen again.
That's because, right. Yeah.
So this is what we're trying to do with this book, is to really reveal the truth, to say, look, this has happened, and it has happened under your own eyes, and you let it happen. We're talking specifically on the antiquities.
Yeah, yeah.
But many other things have happened, of course, with the government, but we're focusing on the antiquities.
That's right. What can you say about the 17th of December 2011, last year, the Egyptian Scientific Institute was destroyed, burnt, basically, right?
Well, you see, let me compare this to what happened in Iran during the 1977 Iranian Revolution. I happened to be in Iran at the time. I was working in Iran, so I've been around revolutions quite a few times.
There we go. Don't go where Robert goes, by the way, people. No, I'm just joking.
Well, I'm going to get accused of stirring them up. Right?
Exactly. There's one common denominator in all these revolutions. It's Robert Bofill. All right, let's go.
Well, what happened in Iran was that there was a counter-revolution activity. And it was known later on that what the government was doing was to create situations where the revolutionaries were accused of doing things which, in fact, they hadn't done, to show them being irresponsible and aggressive and destructive. So I don't know about the institute that was burned, but there is two sides of the story. The young revolutionists say, no, it's not us. We wouldn't do such a thing. And on the other hand, the army is saying, yes, they. But there are reports that the army were actually occupying the institute at the time. So I won't put it past the situation that it's been kind of a coup monté, as we say in French, a kind of plot.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell. There's such chaos and such conflicting and unsourced reports, and so that it's hard to tell what's really going on. And you really have to be down on the ground and talk to the right people to know what's going on. For example, the military is the situation now. In case your listeners are interested to know. There's been a lot of talk about where all this is going. And as you may know, they've had the parliamentary elections, which are over.
Yeah.
And the majority of seats, of the 508 seats of parliament, have gone to two Islamic parties. The so-called Freedom and Justice Party, which is the Muslim Brotherhood,
yeah,
which has got 46% of the seats. So they don't have a full majority. They need 51 seats to control parliament. But, worryingly, the more radical Islamic party, the so-called Noor party, the party of light, which is really the so-called Salafists, very, very fundamentalist and very aggressive sort of party, have won about 30% of the remainder seats. So, collectively, the Islamists have 70% of control, 70% of parliament.
Wow.
However, yes, it's not very good news. But, however, the Muslim Brotherhood does not get along with the Islamists. So, they're kind of split.
As usual, huh? The split happens right away.
Well, they were split from before. I mean, the Salafists are extremely... Nobody realized that there was such a large movement going on, although, frankly, I could see it very plainly. I mean, I lived in Egypt recently, as you know, from 2005 to 2008. Mm. I was living in Cairo at the time. And people were saying, no, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood does not have a majority. There's only about 15% in the country, you know, and they'll never win an election. But it was very obvious to me that there was a very large Islamic influence building up in Egypt, not just recently, but it's been going on for quite a long time. But what we didn't realize is the so-called Salafists. There's a bit of a confusion who these Salafists are. And they're in fact split in many groups themselves, so it's not clear. But in a nutshell, they are in a sense, an offshoot of the Wahhabis of Saudi Arabia. And they're actually funded, apparently, by the Saudi Arabian government. And as you know, the Wahhabis are very, very radical. Well, radical perhaps is the word, but they're very fundamentalist in their view. Saudi Arabia runs its laws under the so-called Sharia law, which is the law according to the Quran, but even then it's interpreted in a very conservative and aggressive manner. You know, women have to be veiled, and they have to be separated from men in public areas, and so forth, as you probably heard.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what the Salafists want to introduce in Egypt, which is unthinkable, really. Egypt and Egyptian society is much, much more sophisticated and has been sophisticated for quite a long time. But they, surprisingly, won quite a lot of votes. So the situation is rather in a precarious position. However, having said this, even though parliament is clearly and finally in the hands of an Islamic majority, there still remains the drawing of the constitution, and this is really the big event that apparently will take place very soon. Perhaps in April or May, if not sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And everything depends on who and how this new constitution will be drafted.
Yeah.
So,
Robert, just let me ask these questions then. Again, briefly, more you know, rhetorical in that sense. Who are the revolutionaries? Is there a chance, Robert, that the Muslim Brotherhood, other Islamic interests, still has an interest in actually in destroying the old country of Egypt as a way of tying this together with the destruction of all the antiquities in Egypt overall?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, no. I believe that the Muslim Brotherhood, even though the name sounds rather off-putting, they're much more moderate than we think. I mean, look, Egypt has been an Islamic country since the 7th century, and even in modern times. I've lived in Egypt for 30 years, but Islam, moderate Islam, is not a problem. I mean, there's really no problem with moderate Islam that allows civil rights and human rights and is operated under a legal system that is fair and recognizes all people as being equal. So Egypt was very much run this way for quite a long time in modern times. But it's not the Muslim Brotherhood that is demanding these extreme conditions. It's the Salafists. The Salafists have come up with crazy proposals. I mean, they, which of course at the moment everybody's laughing at them, but it's kind of worrying. I mean, they wanted to segregate beaches. They wanted to stop women wearing bathing suits. They wanted to stop alcohol. You know, all this kind of nonsense. Which I say nonsense because Egypt is in dire need of other attention. It has the economy that is in chaos, its social services are in chaos, and whoever takes government will have to be able to manage these problems rather than worry about bikinis and
beers on the beach. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean,
tourism would go down the toilet if that happened, obviously.
Indeed. Now they've retracted and they said, no, it's some crazy other people within our groups who are saying this and it's not us, but it's very confusing. And of course, some stupid comments have been made about antiquities. And they want they feel that certain statues are offensive, and they want to cover them. Others have gone as far as saying we should cover the Sphinx and things like that. And it's absolutely ridiculous. And at the moment, everybody's taking this with a bit of a grin. But it's certainly putting the wrong kind of messages to world tourism. I'm taking a group, by the way, as we will talk in a minute, very soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I'm on a daily basis with my correspondents in Cairo, and they're telling me, "Oh, I mean, this is a lot of," which, in fact, you know, to be fair, I mean, one has had to expect this kind of things happening. I mean, you know, when the French Revolution took place in 1789, wasn't it? Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of nonsense went about. I mean, they actually tried to de-Christianize France. As you remember, we talked about in one of the interviews.
That's right, yeah.
And they tried to create a new religion, the religion of the so-called supreme being. And all sorts of crazy things were being proposed. They even changed the calendar. They changed the legal system. So, you know, one has to expect that kind of chaos in a post-revolution situation. I mean, there's bound to be groups that come out and say, okay, here is the opportunity and we want to... So I think this is really what is happening, is that the Salafists will not have their way. The trouble is that they did win a lot of votes, but again, I'm not surprised because, you know, again, this is one of the truths that has to be faced. The majority of people in Egypt are not educated. There is a vast majority that is still not so well educated, they're totally uninformed, and they were bound to be offered a this or that, you know, and the this is go for Islam because it is pure and it is religious and we can help you and so forth, and don't go for the seculars because you've had the seculars for 60 years, you know, and so it's been put in a simple way. Many of the other parties and the revolutionary parties, the liberal parties, the new democratic parties wanted to postpone elections. They wanted to give more time for the people to be informed so that they would vote properly for the things they really want. Because ultimately what all Egyptians want, okay, let's say what they don't want. They don't want what they had before. There's no doubt about it. They don't want a dictatorship, they don't want to be oppressed.
Military funded by foreign money, for instance, things like that?
Yes, they all do not want the army to run the country. Yeah. And the truth is that the army has run the country for the last 60 years. And although people are saying the Supreme Council has been in power since the January Revolution, This is not true. All the presidents of Egypt were ex-colonels and ex-officers of the army. The very first president of Egypt, Mohammed Naguib, and then Gamal Abdel Nasser were all officers from the army. And then Sadat, and then Mubarak. So really, the country has been run by military junta, and even though the president was dressed in civilian clothes, he was really an army man.
Yeah, and, yeah. So they just want to be free of this control. They want to be able to run their own country.
They want this way of ruling the country with an iron fist to stop. So everybody does not want this. There's no question that they want the army to retreat back to the barracks and do the job they're supposed to do, is protect the country from on its borders and stay there. They don't want the army to meddle and run the courts and run military courts, as has been going on not only the last 60 years, but especially in the last year. You know, there is 12,000 people that have been put in jail since the revolution through military courts, civilians. So this is not on.
Yeah.
And although they've released about 1,500, I understand, in the last few days, the army has not behaved in accordance to the will of the people. And they are really angry with this. So everybody agrees on this. What everybody doesn't agree on is who should run the country. You know, should it be an Islamic parliament, or should it be under Sharia, or should it be a democratic, liberal government modeled on European standards, or should it be a combination of both? So there's a whole confusion as to what they want. They know what they don't want, they don't know what they really want. So this is a bit worrying.
Something they have to work out for amongst themselves, obviously. I feel that the more foreign interests get in there, the worse it gets, always. You know, do you think that they could settle this among themselves?
Hopefully. I mean, in 2 days' time, by the way, there is the celebrations of the 25th of January, which is the first year celebrations of the revolution.
Ah.
And there's already a lot of activity going on. On the one hand, the army wants to celebrate. They are going to parade and so forth. And they've arranged for musical concerts and all sorts of activities. On the other hand, the revolutionaries, who are very angry that the army has, in a sense, appropriated itself of the revolution, want to protest. And they're calling for a national strike. And on the other hand, a lot of people are saying, well, look, enough's enough. You know, I mean, let's just wait to see what happens with the elections and take it from there. So there is this kind, and then, of course, the Islamists in the middle saying, saying nothing at the moment. So you've got this situation, and we hope that in 2 days' time things will not
flare up again or something like that.
The situation really is that by demanding and they got this, the departure of the president, the revolution hasn't been taken to its full conclusion. Removing the president was just removing the head of a large monster that is still there. The old regime is still very present. But there is no question that the old regime cannot survive. It cannot survive, and it's very clear even to the army that the power has to be handed over to a elected government, a properly elected government, whatever the choice is. Now, the free elections have, in a sense, provided the means for the Islamists to move in. By having free elections, they were able to persuade people to vote for them and to move in and hopefully, in their view, take control. So that is the downside, if you like, of free elections.
Yeah, but at the same time, then, I mean, they must be able to, I mean, so be it, right? Either it's a democracy and you can vote for who you want to or not, you know. So
I think the upshot and the good thing is that it has opened not only free elections, but it has opened dialogue. People are actually talking. Mm-hmm. People are debating. People are discussing what is good and not good and so forth, whereas before nobody did.
That's right.
So
yeah.
It has opened dialogue, and parliament will be much more liberal now. to debate various points, rather than just say to the president, "Yes, you're wonderful and everything is okay." So this is the good thing. So Egypt has finally got its liberal democracy, even though they're not getting perhaps the government that they want, or at least the revolutionaries want. But that is okay, because if the new government does not perform, whether it's Islamist or liberal or whatever, because at the end, whoever takes Egypt and controls Egypt will have to be able to control the economy, will have to be able to improve the social services, will have to be able to give the people what they really want. Mm. So if they're not able to do that, they'll be outvoted. So at least this is what has come out of all this.
Yeah. And if they're not outvoted, maybe then a second revolution. What this is saying is that, okay, at this stage then, I still have my questions, actually, who the revolutionaries are, how they got funded, weapons. There's a number of questions there. But let's just go for the official story as it is right now. What it shows is that at least then there could be a second, a third, fourth, etc. revolutions until, you know, they're happy with what they have, right?
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, to take this a little bit further, I am optimistic, and people who are well-informed are optimistic. The thing that we're all watching for now is not so much whether the Islamists are going to bring stupid rules like bikinis and remove. What we're watching and hope it will go in the right direction is the drafting of the constitution. Because whatever government takes power, they will have to abide to a constitution. And a constitution, hopefully, that will protect human rights, will be governed under the rule of law, will look for the good and nurturing of the population, a proper constitution, with a very careful. You see, one of the problems with the existing constitution, which of course was not really applied, was that it gave full power to the president. The president had executive power over the whole country, over parliament. And therefore Mubarak, if he didn't like something, he would say yes or no, you know. So really it was not a democratic government, although they wanted to see it this way. It was really ruled like a pharaoh, really. I mean,
exactly.
Mubarak ran the country as if it belonged to them.
Yeah.
So this new constitution will hopefully be a proper constitution, and no matter whether it is an Islamic government or a secular government or a combination of both, they will have to abide to the constitution. And this is the most important thing that we're looking for in the next couple of months. Mm. If they manage to do this, and then followed by a presidential election, which is supposed to take place at the end of June, and that the army, as promised, hands over power to this new elected government and the new president, then there is a lot of hope for Egypt. A lot of hope. And they will iron out all these confusion that they will have slowly. Egypt is a country that can be extremely prosperous. It has everything in its favor, provided that it is managed in the right way. You know, it is a country that has, well, it has an amazing tourist potential, as we all know.
Yeah.
It has human resources, which are untapped. It has 90 million people that could be put to use. It has an amazing amount of industrial and agricultural possibilities. But it has to be ruled by people who genuinely and honestly want to make it better, rather than worry about their own pockets. And coming to the antiquities now, this is what we are hoping for as well. Because even though we had Mr. Hawass, Dr. Hawass, trumpeting his fame and telling us how he was protecting antiquities and all these wonderful things he was doing, in reality, he was really promoting his own persona, he was promoting his own position, and, well, we'll see, probably promoting his own pocket. And antiquities suffered. You know, there were sensationalist projects like building a wall around the Giza pyramids and building a new reception center and a new museum. But the truth is that the majority of antiquities in the country were badly managed. Some of them were being plundered. Some of them were being vandalized. I mean, you know my story with Lapta Playa, for example.
That's right, yeah.
And all this was left to be. And while the man was more concerned with appearing on television and selling hats, you know. So
right.
We are glad he's out of the way. And the new man is doing so far the right thing. Although, like I said, there's a bit of a confusion who's in control, because there is a new Ministry of Antiquities now again. And there is a new Minister of Antiquities. And the Supreme Council of Antiquities, although in control of the antiquities, has to report to the Minister of Antiquities. And the Supreme Council of Antiquities is run by Mustafa Amin, as you know. He's okay. I'm quite happy with him. I mean, he seems to be doing the right thing. He seems to be holding his position. He seems to be not seeking sensationalism and doing his job, really. I mean, mm-hmm. his job, how was his job in the first place, was to manage the antiquity department. In other words, to ensure the management of the sites and to ensure their protection and to ensure the payments of the guards and to train them, not to go on television. You know, Hawass began to see himself as a kind of celebrity that was going to promote Egyptian tourism and promote Egyptian culture and so forth. That wasn't his job. And all this, of course, created a lot of attention towards him. But that was not his job. His job was to ensure the management and the proper organization of the antiquity department, which is really what is needed. We need to control and manage these antiquities for future generations. You know, it's very, very important. And coming back to the book I'm doing, this is what we're bringing to the surface. You know, let's look at the past. Let's look at all the mistakes that were done. Let's be honest. Let's really say what has to be said, and let's move forward in the right way.
Mm. So, Robert, since you're doing these tours now then down in Egypt, I want to get into that in a little bit of detail here. I want you to tell us about it. How, though, is the accessibility now to some of the sites that you're going to visit? Has anything been restricted as far as you know, or is it all open and you can come in there with your passports? Is everything okay, so to speak?
Absolutely. I mean, to tell you from my last experience, I was there in November, so very, quite recently, with a group of about 25 people. And I was, of course, there in May, as you know, on the old Nile Valley tour, which we did in May last year. And Egypt is fine. I mean, you go there as normal. You arrive at Cairo Airport. You get a visa on the spot. And as far as the sites are concerned, you know, there's a silver lining to this situation, is that because of the low volume of tourism, those who do come are thrilled, because you have some of the sites to yourselves. I mean,
really? Wonderful then.
Even for me, it's absolutely fantastic, because although I've been to many of these sites many, many times, and I've had the privilege of seeing them outside hours and sometimes at night and so forth, I've been really amazed to take a group, for example, at Abu Simbel, in the famous temple of Ramses II on Lake Nasser. And believe it or not, I had a group of 40 people, and we were the only ones on that site in the morning. And they had the site from dawn for 2-3 hours just to ourselves. So it was absolutely incredible.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely loved it. I mean, and we had many, many of these wonderful events when we went to the site of the Valley of the Kings. As you know, the Valley of the Kings is usually extremely crowded, and you have to queue to enter some of the tombs. Well, again, we went there in the afternoon, and there was just, I think, one or two other groups. So it really was very, very good. So on the one hand, yes, it's detrimental to Egyptian income and tourism. But for those who brave it now, and frankly, there is really nothing to worry about. I mean, we didn't have any incident whatsoever. I mean, not just us. Since the revolution, since January last year to today, there hasn't been one incident involving a tourist.
Yeah.
Nobody has been bothered. Nobody has been harassed. On the contrary.
That's great.
So, I mean, those who want to come to Egypt for the first time, this is the moment, because you will never see it again like this. I mean, there has been a case, although when we went to the pyramids, there was a few people, but very few, really very few compared to the numbers that you usually get. There's been a case of an Englishman going to the pyramids, I think it was in May, and he was alone.
Completely alone?
Oh, yeah.
You're kidding me. That's unheard of, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I went alone. I mean, I actually went alone to the pyramids of Abu Sir. You know, and it's quite amazing, you know, considering.
How is it with the... Are there guards there? People who are still, you know, connected to the antiquities?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. It's still very much the same. There is the normal guards, the normal tourist police. The mood is different. It's much more pleasant. You know, the mood throughout Egypt is different. I think this is one of the good things of the revolution. There is a very positive mood. The people are more open to discussion. They welcome foreigners. I mean, the foreigners have always been welcome, but particularly after the revolution. They know that we supported their movement. They know that we are supporting other Arab movements, like in Libya and in Syria and in Yemen. And so Europeans in particular are very, very welcome. And so the mood has changed. The visits on the sites are much more relaxed. You can spend more time meditating. And so it really, it's just the right time. I mean, I'm very much looking forward to go again, because for me it is such a pleasure to take a group and have some of the places virtually to ourselves.
And you're heading off here in a week or two basically here in early February. You have two different events upcoming, so let's talk about these, Robert.
Yes, let me give you a rundown on this, because I would very much like to have some Scandinavian people come again, by the way. We've had some come in May, and they absolutely loved it.
Excellent.
And I think thanks to you did some good announcements for us.
Excellent. Well, that's great. Some of our listeners got interested and hooked up with you guys there. That's really good.
Yes. Well, the good thing with Scandinavians that they, all of them, I think, speak English, so they can join our group, and they usually have a great time. Okay. Well, the tour that I would really like to talk about is what I call the All Nile Valley Tour. I do this tour twice a year. And this year, this coming February, we have the All Nile Valley Tour, which runs from the 12th of February until the 25th of February. And let me explain what it entails. Literally, as the name implies, it is you're going to see all of the Nile Valley, all of Egypt, from the tip of the Mediterranean, from Alexandria, all the way south along the Nile to Abu Simbel. So we do literally the whole of Egypt. It's an amazing adventure. It's an amazing experience. We see, of course, all the major sites in the Cairo area, the pyramid area, the Giza pyramids, of course, Saqqara, Dashur. We try to add a few more here and there if we have the spare time, like Abu Sir and the Sun Temples. In Upper Egypt, where we fly there actually with the local flights, and in Upper Egypt, the tour in Upper Egypt is partly a cruise, which I'll describe in a minute, and partly on land by coach. We arrive in Aswan, and we immediately take a coach to go to Abu Simbel, where we spend the night. And I have a very, very special event in Abu Simbel, especially at this time of year, because around the... towards the middle part of February, the sun, as I think we discussed it once before on your interviews, the sun is in perfect alignment with the temple of Abu Simbel. And at dawn, it shines its rays into the temple, and we are going to be there at dawn with a group to witness this event and experience the symphony in stone, I call it.
Is that a particular alignment? Why now in February, do you know?
It occurs twice a year. The temple was designed to receive the rays of the sun on the 19th of October and the 19th of February. So I've planned it so that we're going to be very close to the date. We're there on the 17th, but the sun, of course, is moving very slowly, and we have the rays of the sun at sunrise. As the sun breaks over the eastern horizon, it shoots its rays into the temple, the great temple of Ramses II, Abu Simbel. The temple is literally cut into the rock, and it goes 60 meters into the depth of the rock, where at the far end there is the famous statues of Ramses, flanked by three deities, the god Amun, the god Horakhti, Ramses himself, and the god Khnum. And the rays of the sun being concentrated at the entrance of the gate of the temple shoot literally like a laser beam right into the temple. It's very spectacular. I don't know if you've seen.
I haven't seen that particular one. I've seen other examples, but I haven't heard about this one in Abu Simbel, no.
Oh, it's very spectacular. I was there. Maybe you can get us on YouTube, some of your potential guests.
Yeah, well, exactly. You guys should bring a little DV camera. That would be a great promo to, of course, show some of the stuff there that you...
We did. I did an interview once there during that. You see, it's kind of strange. As you are inside the temple, we put people on the side, so on the side of the entrance, so that they don't obstruct the sun rays. And as the sun comes up, literally, you see the light of the sun being concentrated like through a magnifying glass, and it shoots, like I said, like a laser beam. It literally shoots horizontal and illuminates the far end of the temple, and it's kind of spooky. It really is. I mean, you feel like it's almost artificial, but it's
how deep into it does it go there, approximately?
60 meters.
60 meters. That's pretty good. Yeah.
And so we stay there, and it lasts for about 20 minutes. So there's amazing moments where, like I say, the temple becomes alive. It's meant to become active with the light of the sun. So the sun, or the sun energy, is a kind of energizer, if you like. It's like charging a battery. And the temple seems to become alive. You know, the statue are illuminated, and you get this very eerie feeling of literally being part of it. It's a very, very interesting experience. Anyway, we do that, and then we will visit all the sites in Aswan. I have a very special visit at the temple of Phila, the temple of Isis on the island of Phila. I make a point to go there at dawn, and we sit there and watch the temple light up with the sunlight. And so we do all these wonderful things. I add a few off the beaten track events. One of the things I like doing with my groups in Aswan is that although we board the main cruise ship that we will sail down the Nile, I usually rent a couple of local boats, and I take the group to the Nubian village. Have you been there, Henry?
I've never been to Egypt, actually, so...
What?
Nope.
Henrik, you must come.
I know. I'm still working on it. I'm trying to get down there. So the answer is no, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, let me work on this then. I'll get you on the tour. Well, the Nubian village is still one of the old surviving village of the Nubians. And as you know from my work on my last book, Black Genesis, I've pointed out that the origins of the pharaonic civilization is from a black African origins, and the Nubians are definitely the descendants of these original Egyptians. So it's wonderful to go and see their village, which is still very much in the old style. Mm-hmm. But on the way there with these local boats, I stop on a beach. There's these wonderful sandy beaches along the Nile near the cataract, where the water trickles down and is very, very clean and pure. And we swim. You know, we literally all swim and have this amazing experience of almost being in a pharaonic setting, you know, with the water buffaloes and the herons and the reeds. And they love it. I mean, it's you can see it on my Facebook. So very I do nice. A lot of this stuff. Mm. And then we sail down the Nile towards Luxor, and we stop at Kovombo Temple, the Temple of Sobek. We stop at Edfu, the Temple of Horus, which is, again, a fantastic experience. And then we stop finally at Luxor, where we spend 3 days to visit the Temple of Luxor, of course. I do a night visit there. And that is one of the culminating points of this tour. I do a night visit from sunset to about 9:30 in the evening, where the Temple of Luxor is literally illuminated with artificial lights. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the only way to describe it, it's like entering a fairy tale. It's really extraordinary. You know, you wander around this temple being illuminated by orange tungsten lighting, and the statues become alive, and you're free to wander around. You know, people go and in nooks and sit down and chat, and it's an amazing experience. You know, you return back to the ship and you feel like you've been in a wonderland. It's a kind of a it's like entering a myth. It's really fantastic. And then we sail. We visit, of course, Karnak at dawn. I do a dawn visit at Karnak. We visit the West Bank, the Valley of the Kings, the Temple of Medinet Habu, the Ramesseum, Hatshepsut Temple, and so forth. And then comes the fun part. Again, we take a coach from Luxor, and we drive northwards. We visit Dendera, the famous temple of Hathor. On the way, we stop at Abydos to visit the temple of Seti and the famous Osirian. And this is the pinnacle, because
that's a nice one.
It is not just the most marvelous temple of Egypt. It's the best temple in the world. There is nothing like it. I mean, Abydos is really you feel like you're entering a museum full of art pieces, and yet they're 3,000 years old. Mm. There's still the colors on the wall, and the artists who did this, you can tell they're extremely high quality. It's like the Da Vinci's and Michelangelo's of pharaonic Egypt. It's really superb. And we spend a lot of time there, and we sit down and talk, and you know that kind of tours, by the way, is a lot of interacting. We sit very often around the statues, and we discuss, and people tell us their mood and their feelings. We meditate, so there's a lot of this going on. Mm. And then we carry on to El Minya in Middle Egypt, and this trip from Abydos in Middle Egypt, we literally drive across Middle Egypt, is, I describe it as flying on a magic carpet, because you're literally driving in this bus. We have this very sophisticated and modern bus, and you're driving along the Nile Valley, passing through all these villages, and you look out of the window, and you feel like you're in medieval times. I mean, it's like you're on a magic carpet passing through medieval Egypt. Anyway, we reach El Minya, and we spend the night there. And then, in the morning, we do our last visit, which is the city of Akhenaten at Tell el Amarna. And there we spend a lot of time in this very eerie place. It's a place where history comes and hits you in the face, because it's where these great events took place, as you know, the story of Akhenaten and the heretical and the civil war and all this. And we discuss all the theories there, and then we drive to Cairo. And we arrive in Cairo, and everybody is exhilarated. Many of them do not want to leave, I can tell you that.
After what, 12, 13 days being on the road there, seeing a lot of things? Yeah,
They've been 12 days in a kind of dream. And they interact, and many of them become friends for life. And I enjoy it every time. And I usually take my brother, who is coming with me again this time, because he's very much involved in the work I do, and he acts as the Egyptian public relations man, because he speaks Arabic like me, and he does all the stuff that I do not have time to do when they want to buy things and they want to go and visit something more specific, or or they want to know how the pyramids were built because he's an architect, so he spent a lot of time discussing things like that. So really, it's by the time we returned to Cairo, it's been like a magical mystery tour, and you know, there's this kind of sad mood when we have our last supper, and then everybody goes home. And I can tell you, I mean, we have people not only keeping in touch for years and years, but we have people coming back. I mean, I've got several people coming back this on this tour in February that have been with us in May.
They want to go through it again, huh? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know I'm blowing my trumpet here, but it is a very, very special tour, and it is a tour that even I, every time, is although we visit the same places, every tour is different, and there is a kind of gelling of the people. This is wonderful to see. Because they feel like they're doing something unique and special, and they happen to be together. You know, there's this kind of strange feeling that somehow fate brought them together, and they feel connected. And there's a lot of discussion going on in the evening, and many. I even invite people of the tour to give talks, because some of them, many of the guests we have, are experts in many fields, and so there is a lot of this interaction.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, Danny, will be a little bit different now then, considering all the things that we have been talking about so far, in terms of maybe less people at some of the sites as well? What do you think?
Well, I think there will be less people, but that's good, like I said. I mean, I'm sorry for the Egyptian tourism, but
sure.
It's good for us. But I think it will be special, because, for example, the tour begins literally on the 12th, and people will be arriving on the 11th, some arrive on the 12th. And that is the day, of course, when Mubarak was ousted on the 11th of February. So there's a kind of mood of it isn't just a tour where it is the tour that I've just described, but there's a kind of mood that we are perhaps among the very first of these tours that is celebrating this new Egypt, this new mood of Egypt. And we want to give the example. You know, we want to show how it's all wonderful. I mean, you know, and hopefully other people will come. So I have a feeling that it will be very special. There will be this, you know, I expect the Egyptians to be even more welcoming and more enthusiastic. And so I'm looking forward to it. And I hope we get some of your Scandinavian listeners thinking that this is probably for them.
Absolutely. So those capable, those interested, where do they go on the website, Robert, to find out more information? And give us the website,
well,
obviously.
Okay, yeah. Here comes the commercial bit. It's very simple. If they go on my website, which is www.robertboval.co.uk. I will repeat the end, .co.uk. Not .com, because .com has been stolen from me, and they advertise all sorts of funny things and pornography. So we don't want you to go there. We want you to go to robertboval.co.uk, and you will have all the information you need. And if you think you are one of those that has to see Egypt, well, grab this opportunity, because this is the one and only time. I don't think it will be repeated again. You know, this opportunity of seeing Egypt at just the right time, with the right mood and with the right people.
Excellent. Yeah. robertboval.co.uk. We will have this the link up, obviously, on redhousecreations.com as well, in case you don't know how to spell the name. So everything will be up there, and so take a look there. And there's obviously all the information is right there on the front page with the banner and everything as well. And what you've been talking about here is obviously the All Nile Valley Tour, right? Because
yes,
there's another one.
Can I add something else?
Sure. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, one of the things that I would like to say this time on this tour is that I've invited two very, very special guests. Patricia and Yusuf Awiyan. Patricia and Yusuf Awiyan. Yusuf is the son of a very, very famous Egyptologist who became a mystic, the famous professor Hakim.
Oh.
Many people
have
heard of him.
Sure.
You know Hakim?
Yeah.
Who died a few years ago. Yusuf is his son and has taken over his father's mission, and he married recently Patricia, an American lady, a beautiful lady, who together they've started the Kemetian School, and I've invited them to be our guests throughout this tour. And they really are fantastic. They cater for that side of the tour where we are looking for a deeper approach to ancient Egypt. We look into the more esoteric side of the experience we can have. So I'm very, very happy that they're with us. So again, this is a unique opportunity. We're going to have a really good time with them along this tour. And of course, like I said, my brother is coming along. My brother is the nuts and bolts man. He covers all the construction side, the how they move the stones and all the theories. I'm of course the astronomy and the alignments and the historical alternative history and the age of the Sphinx. And then we have the I1s, Patricia and Yusuf, who are going to cover the more profound esoteric side of this. So I think it's going to be quite a brew. And with the mood that's going on in Egypt, it's just that very special tour. So come along.
All right. Excellent, Robert. Again, on the website, we'll give you more information. This has been really excellent having you back again, talking about both the past a little bit here of Egypt, of what has been happening, but also the future, and hopefully things will go in the right direction for Egypt and the whole, basically, well, it is an industry, it's a tourist industry, but hopefully much more can open up when it comes to the ancient knowledge of Egypt, obviously, as a consequence. But as we always say, we have to watch and see, I guess, Robert. Huh?
Absolutely. You know what? I'll end by saying this. The Egyptians are very special people. They are fun-loving people. They are optimists. Anybody who's been to Egypt will tell you this. They are friendly, and they love life. They are people who love life, and I'm very much an optimist. Egypt will be okay. It's just going through a bad patch at the moment, and it has to get its balance. We have a wonderful word that we use throughout the Arab world, but particularly Egypt, and we say Inshallah, if God willing. You know, and everybody's optimistic, and I think we're going to see a wonderful Egypt in the next few years. And I'd like to be part of it. We're planning very special tours, by the way, in the future, so I'll keep you informed.
Oh, excellent. Sounds really good, Robert. Thanks again then for coming on. Have a blast on the tour when you go here in a couple of weeks then, Robert.
Well, I've got to have you on my tours next time. I wish you had told me we'd have got you on this one. But
let's talk about that then. Yeah,
absolutely.
For sure, you bet. Thanks, Robert.
Okay, Henry. Nice talking to you. Bye.
We have two shows going out to you next here. One with Alex Putney on the strange sound phenomena that we've heard worldwide. We are going to try to clarify some of the questions and break it down for you from our different perspectives, what really is going on there. Then next up after that, shortly after, we have our program with Carl Munk. But also in the pipeline, Jeff Hilling on the Patterson film Bob Frisell on changes and transformation through 2012. So much more to come. Click into our radio archive, check out our other upcoming guests. These include Asharia S., Anthony Peake, Andrew Goff, Mark Passio, Dr. Robert Verkirk, Joseph Atwill, Sonia Barrett, Håkan Blomqvist, Barbara Handklau, and Josh Reeves, to name a few. You're welcome to tune in again. We'll be back with more shortly. RedIceCreations.com, that's the website. Don't forget to subscribe to our member section. Of course, as well to our newsletter and our RSS feeds. Take a look at our iPhone app for the latest radio programs. We're making it as convenient as we possibly can for you to get our program. Thank you for listening. We will talk more soon in just a few days.